We're taking a look at the Psalms in all of their variety, and we've already considered the major forms of expression in the Psalms, the kinds of synonymous and antithetical and stair-like parallelism. We've looked at the structure of the book of Psalms as a whole and the five different sub-books that are involved in it, and we begin to talk about the specific variety of psalms that are also among the 150 individual expressions. We've looked at individual laments and communal laments, each of which are ways in which we as individuals or as communities express our difficulties in the circumstances of our lives and our need for God to come and participate with us in some kind of larger deliverance. We've also looked at the hymns of praise, which have helped us talk about the language of love and the manner in which God is, in fact, our God of deliverance. Today we're going to take a look at those psalms which are what I call wisdom or priestly instruction. These are the psalms which are not so much designed to help us address God as they are designed to help us pass along knowledge and wisdom and the values of a life and a society to the next generation. These are poems which contain condensed teachings, and poetry makes it possible for these ideas to be memorized and quickly transmitted from one group to the succeeding generations. There are quite a number of these. Some of them are very short, but most of them are modest in length. The very first psalm, Psalm 1, we're going to take a look at it, is one of those wisdom psalms or those instruction psalms, and they go all the way through. There's no particular area of the Psalter that contains more than others. Psalm 1 is a very interesting psalm of wisdom or instruction. Blessed is the one who does not walk with the step of the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of the mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and who meditates on his law day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and whose leaf does not wither, whatever they do prospers. Not so the wicked, they are like the chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. Very compact, but a lot of comparison and a lot of insight in all of that. There's a comparison made between two types of people, those who acknowledge God and worship Him, and those who choose not to. While many of their actions in life may seem quite similar, the outcomes of their existences are very different. And so the psalm itself is divided into two parts. And in that first part, it focuses on the blessings that accrue to the person who is righteous. Doesn't mean the person does absolutely everything right, but does mean that there's a heart direction toward God, a desire to participate in the things of God, an attitude that the Creator matters and that this should shape and form the days and expressions of my life. The wicked in that first half are seen as in opposition to that. Because they're in opposition to the ways of God, they're also in opposition to those who delight in God. And so there's this sense of us versus them. Of course, this is in a kind of poetic or summary form, so it's divided into two different kinds of people. And that comes through in the second half. In the second half, the wicked are derided for denying the Creator's intentions and for their desire to harm the righteous. Again, as I said before, that these psalms are not directed toward God as prayers. Instead, they're the testimony of those who have learned a thing or two in life, who know and who love God, now seeking to pass along this wisdom about God and the ways of life to the next generation. So you can imagine that this would be one of those songs which would be sung by parents as they were putting children to bed. I know that my parents used to tell us early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Those kinds of things are expressions of values that are then transmitted to the next generation, and this psalm would be used exactly for that. In this sense, the psalm is actually an educating tool. Here's another one, Psalm 15. It's a psalm of David. Notice that it's still fairly near the beginning of the collection of psalms, and probably something that David reflected on as he was in the process of or had already brought the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem. During the first part of David's life, the Ark of the Covenant was still in the tabernacle, which was the tent-like structure that had traveled with the Israelites through the wilderness. It was parked when the Israelites came into the land of Canaan, about in the middle of the country at a place called Shiloh. Now, when David established his throne, his kingdom, and reflected on what had gone wrong with his predecessor Saul, essentially what had gone wrong is that Saul had not placed God at the center of the nation. David wanted something quite different, of course. David wanted God to be seen and known and experienced as king, and so David wanted the throne of the king of Israel, the Ark of the Covenant, to be center in his capital city. He wanted also to build a permanent house for God. We'll hear about that in, for instance, 2 Samuel 5, 6, and 7. David had a desire that God would have a permanent residence in the same way that all the Israelites had permanent residences. What didn't happen, though, was David creating that because God came to him through the prophet Nathan and said, "You're a man of war. It'll be the task of a man of peace, your descendant, your son, who will make that happen." So we're in the process of God's throne room and palace being established, but David himself is not going to do it. Still, he understands that not he, but Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the true king of the land. So here's what David says about that. "Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent?" Notice it's still a tent, not a palace. "Who may live on your holy mountain?" And the answer given, "The one whose walk is blameless, who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from the heart, whose tongue utters no slander, who does no wrong to a neighbor and casts no slur on others, who despises a vile person but honors those who fear the Lord." Notice the antithetic parallelism there. "Who keeps an oath even when it hurts and does not change their mind. Who lends money to the poor without interest. Who does not accept a bribe against the innocent." And then the conclusion, which is a reflection of that first verse, "Whoever does these things will never be shaken." Notice that the psalm begins with that synonymous parallelism question, and then ends with a concluding synonymous parallelism, directly given answer to the question that was raised in the first. In that first verse, there's one question posed twice for poetic emphasis. Who will go up to, who will dwell on the tent and the mountain of the Lord, synonymous parallelism there. And the question itself, there's a response to that in the center part, the bulk of the psalm, and then very specifically addressed in that last synonymous parallelism. So there's great development and balance to the psalm, and sort of this this look at how things develop from beginning to end. "The behaviors of the righteous encompass social activities of many dimensions, both outwardly expressed and inwardly thought or imagined." What does it mean for a person to be in tune with God? What does it mean for a person to be of righteous character? And so in that center section, you have a variety of expressions of that. And now holiness is the sort of theme that shot through the whole thing. And it's both a process and a reflection. It's a process of doing the right and being in tune with the right, being in tune with God. At work in one's life and at play, all of these things are sort of bubbling to the surface in me. So worship is the outcome of right living, and if we desire to worship well, we need to live well. It's a very powerful psalm, even though it's quite short. A third example of this wisdom summarized in some meaningful way. A much longer expression of it in Psalm 37. Again, a Psalm of David. Notice that it's fairly near the beginning of the book of Psalms. Listen to the collection. It's almost like a whole lot of things put together, almost like a bunch of proverbs listed together that collectively have a larger idea of purpose. Do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong, for like the grass, they will soon wither, like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord and trust in him and he will do this. He will make your righteous reward shine like the dawn, while your vindication like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil. For those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. David continues on with these ideas throughout many more verses of Psalm 37. And it's almost as if every several lines brings a new thought, which is dwelled on for a little while and then moved on again. Notice near the end here, "For the Lord loves the just and will not forsake his faithful ones. Wrongdoers will be completely destroyed. The offspring of the wicked will perish. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. The mouths of the righteous utter wisdom, and their tongues speak what is just. The law of God is in their hearts. They do not; their feet do not slip. The wicked lie in wait for the righteous, intent in putting them to death. But the Lord will not leave them in the power of the wicked, or let them be condemned when brought to trial. Hope in the Lord and keep his way. He will exalt you, and you will inherit the land." In the very last lines of the psalm, "The salvation of the righteous comes from the Lord. He is their stronghold in time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him." The psalm is an acrostic. I've mentioned that before. Acrostic psalms are those which have segments, either couplets or longer collections, that begin with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. In this case, there are a couple of couplets together that form each separate group. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and so there are really 22 sections to this psalm expressing the ideas of wisdom about living with God, you might say, from A to Z. And that's also probably why this particular psalm is somewhat choppy. There's a kind of deliberateness in having segments of the psalm beginning with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and they don't necessarily flow together into a unified song so much as they are almost separate stanzas about the same themes. It's crafted deliberately to follow that convention of successive segments, beginning with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. There are so many metaphors used to describe the manner in which God cares about God's people, and God's people themselves respond in different ways to God's care. And righteousness and salvation are always almost opposite sides of a singular coin. Righteousness is how we live. Salvation is what God brings. Salvation is what God brings. Therefore, we live righteous lives. Taking a look at the idea of these songs of wisdom, these instruction psalms, these psalms are essentially teaching tools designed to help people remember why God is to be honored and how the people themselves are to live faithfully before God. Righteousness is connected to right living and also to salvation. And salvation, as it comes, breeds righteousness in those who respond to it. Righteousness is expected of God's people because it is the mark of God's kingly rule and is expressed through them. If God rules, then it ought to be seen. And how is it best seen? Not just through the glories of creation, but through people who live right lives. So the whole point of these psalms, all of them together in this collection, these wisdom psalms or instruction psalms, is to help each generation pass along the right values about living and obeying God and functioning righteously to the next generation. You can imagine that these were memorized as part of the education process. They were sung by families around tables, and they were intended to be passed down from one generation to the next. More on these kinds of things in my devotional meditations on the Psalms, Hear Me, O God, and also more on the structure of these things in my book, Covenant Documents, Reading the Bible Again for the First Time.